now after 12 o'clock, and we have the handsome Chris White with us here in the studio today. And Chris is generally joined by Matt McAuliffe, but I find out that Matt is, in fact, doing... he's doing God's work, I suppose.
Doggone it, yeah. The guy's up at graduate school, actually, so he's pretty excited about getting started, and I'm excited about not having to fight him for the airtime.
Oh, no, I know. I'm just kidding. Cordial relationship.
That's
course,
right. Matt and I are good buddies there. So.
Well, anyway, we'll try to muddle through somehow, but you have a topic today that will certainly lend itself to more than amply a mere 25 minutes. Jan Hus.
Jan Hus. You know, I wonder how many of our listeners this afternoon have ever even heard of Jan Hus. And yet, I'll bet you that if you haven't heard him, you have heard the phrase, your goose is cooked, that little colloquialism.
Yes.
And that colloquialism actually comes from Jan Martyrdom. Anyway, we'll get to that in a little while, why he became a martyr and all that. But right now, I'd really like to talk about who Jan Hus was and why he's important for us to remember today. Hus is born... Pat, in 1374. Okay, so
right.
The 14th century,
wow,
of course, as you remember, is not one of the best centuries to be alive in. That was the time of the plagues and many other problems throughout Europe. And he was born in the land of Bohemia, which we know today as the Czech Republic. And his name actually does mean goose. Hus means goose. And he was actually had a lot of fun with that, and throughout his life was known for coming up with funny and corny little phrases that tied his name in with things. We know practically nothing really about his childhood. His parents were devout Christians, we know that, and they were peasants. And
peasant stock, fine European peasant stock.
You know, and it doesn't
solid,
get any better in that northern European part of the world to be a peasant there. Those are like the salt of the earth kind of people as they immigrated to the United States. But anyway, you know, Hus, even though he was poor, he did have an opportunity for education. And at about age 19, he was able to enter into university,
wow,
got a bachelor's degree, and got a master's degree, and actually became a professor.
Well,
and
this is a local university.
Local
there,
university, yeah, the University of Prague.
University of Prague. So Prague had been around.
Prague had been around.
Was this a country? Just by the way, do you know Bohemia? Was this the area? I mean, it wasn't part of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yes.
No.
Oh, yes.
It was
all very much part of the Holy Roman Empire, tied in with Germany. As a matter of fact, that kind of figures into the story of Jan Hus, its relationship with the Pope and with the Holy Roman Empire.
They weren't speaking. They were German, probably.
They were speaking what we would probably call Czech.
Or Slavic, kind of Slavic.
Some sort of Slavical language there. Anyway, Hus, interesting thing, he studied for the priesthood, and by his own admittance, his main attraction to the priesthood was because he thought, well, you know, that line of work, I can make pretty good money if I get a plum appointment, and people will like me. You know, it's kind of a good social climbing sort of thing.
Okay.
And so, you know, he thought, you know, if I get into the priesthood, I get the right situation, I'm going to be living the life of ease and leisure.
Not too much different than any other aspiring college student.
Exactly.
Today.
You're
big bucks. I'm going to go to college.
Everybody's got to have a plan, you know. And Hus had a plan, except that the Lord kind of upset those plans. And as he studied in university, he actually became converted, and he actually developed quite a spiritual zeal. The more he studied the Word of God, and the more he learned theology,
and he found out this God stuff is really true, and Jesus is the Son of God. And
well,
I have often said
that many times we don't need to worry too much about our motivations in ministry, because God always has a way of applying a corrective to us in one way, and here you know, Hus had agenda, really, you know, kind of a worldly agenda, and yet God corrected him. And, you know, really, honestly, he's ordained as a priest in 1402, and is given a dual assignment. He is a professor at University of Prague, and then he's pastor at what's known in Prague as Bethlehem Chapel. And this could have been probably a relatively sedate life and a quiet life, mm-hmm. and maybe we would have never even heard of Jan Hus, except for the fact that that there were all sorts of historical factors that kind of pressed in on his life. Circumstances make the man. Three of these things that I think would be really pertinent to talking about Hus today was first of all, that the Queen of Bohemia at the time was actually a relative of the royal family in England. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, you know, what difference does that make? Well, the difference was is there became a real strong Bohemia-England connection. And a lot of the best and the brightest and the favored sons of Bohemia traveled to England and studied at England's premier university, which was Oxford University. Yeah. And teaching at that time was a very well-known person that we actually did a show on, I believe, last month or a couple months back, John Wycliffe.
That was last month's show.
That's right. Uh-huh. We were talking about Wycliffe last month. Wycliffe was in his heyday at Oxford and teaching, of course, many of the reforms and ideas about Christianity that were really quite revolutionary at the time. And he was quite popular at Oxford, and many of these students and scholars from Bohemia were studying under Wycliffe and then bringing back these thoughts and ideas into the University of Prague in Czechoslovakia. It really hit Bohemia like a firestorm. University of Prague was almost divided over the issue. About half of the professors thought it was just a bunch of rot, you know, that Wycliffe's ideas were a bunch of mind rot and utterly rejected him. And the other half just fully embraced Wycliffe's reforms. And the interesting thing is that Jan Hus, he was noted for liking Wycliffe and liking a lot of his ideas, but he didn't buy into all of them either. And was not a total Wycliffeite in any way, shape, or form. He liked a lot of his ideas and modified some of them. But Hus was not a rejecter of Wycliffe, but was rather kind of in the middle ground between those who were, you know, just really in favor of Wycliffe's reforms and those who had rejected him outright. The other thing that was going on at the time was simply from the lowliest peasant to the prelate of Bohemia were frankly getting sick of being under the thumb of Germany.
Uh-huh.
Germany was dominating them. You know, they've kind of had a bad habit, now that I think of that, of dominating other countries. But Germany was dominating the affairs of Bohemia, both politically and in the church. And a lot of people were tired of that. The monarchy of Bohemia depended upon their alliance with Germany. And so they didn't apple cart too much, but the rest of the people really were of a mind that things have got to change, and especially things have got to change in the church. And of course, Germany was aligned, and their monarch was on the throne because the Pope appointed him.
Sure.
And so there's that strong tie between the Roman Catholic Church. And then thirdly, if you want to talk about the circumstances that made the man, the Roman Catholic Church at this time was absolutely at their lowest point in corruption and graft and all sorts of troubles. And at this particular point, Pat, they actually had three popes claiming to be the head of the Roman Catholic Church. And there were all sorts of they called it the Great Papal Schism, where there were three people claiming to be the Pope and people that were aligned with them, but there was no universal agreement in Europe as to who was the right Pope. And so there was a lot of disarray and a lot of corruption, and the church, a lot of people within the Catholic Church knew there needed to be some reforms, but it was like, we've got to solve the big problem here, and that is, who actually is supposed to be the Pope here? And so this plays very prominently into the story of Hus. Well, Hus himself, a popular university teacher, but really made his mark as the preacher at Bethlehem Chapel.
Uh-huh.
And Bethlehem Chapel is you know, you kind of think of what, you know, like a little tiny church somewhere. Bethlehem Chapel is like 3,000 people. It seats about 3,000 people.
In Prague, in the 1400s.
Oh yeah, and because they were doing something quite revolutionary there. They got kind of a charter from the king Bohemia, to start this chapel in which they would preach in the people's vernacular language and offer sermons there. And Huss, rather than having them in Latin, and Huss was their preacher, and he was apparently quite a passionate preacher and really saw the power in bringing the Word of God to people and giving sermons in the vernacular language of the people. And so he was very well loved and quite powerful,
influential. I would say. Yeah, yeah.
Well, actually, so influential that the Queen of Bohemia, Queen Sophia, she attended the chapel, really liked Huss, and actually made Huss her chaplain of sorts, her private confessor and chaplain.
Oh,
so
nice.
So Huss had a really great assignment there. Well, you know, when you think of Huss, I like to think of Huss as really kind of a bridge of the reformers between John Wycliffe and Martin Luther. And Martin Luther, of course, is the person we always, when we think of the Protestant Reformation, we always think of Martin Luther. And indeed, he's kind of the guy who, you know, lights off the cannonball that sets off the explosion. But there's all this stuff that's been building beforehand. And you have Wycliffe. Wycliffe focused his reforms really on rethinking the nature of the church. What is the church? Is the church the official leadership, or is the church the people? And what is the purpose of the church? Is the purpose of the church for salvation, or is it where saved people congregate? Martin Luther, really, if you want to take a look at it, how he reformed the church, his focus was upon looking or rethinking the nature of man's relationship with God. Okay, he really looks at the individual's relationship with the Lord. You have somebody like John Calvin, who reformed our way of interpreting and understanding the Bible and church doctrine. But Huss had his own emphasis as well, and it wasn't so much on doctrine. Huss was not a great thinker, if you will, but was rather someone who was more, had a focus on ethics, had a focus on the way we practice Christianity, why people are supposed to do the things they do. Does that make sense to you that, you know, he's not so much looking at interpreting the Bible as taking a look and saying, you know, the
working
way
we, out your salvation.
Yeah, and the way we do things, I don't think measures up to the way God would have us do things. Just, a couple for instances of the way Huss thought, compared to the way the rest of the church thought at the time. You know, Rome believed that a priest's authority to minister was based on his connection to the church. And that as long as he had good standing with the church, that no matter how his morality or his personal lifestyle was, his ministry was still effective, and it made no difference in the life of a believer. Huss, on the other hand, said that's not right, that the basis and the authority of a minister is not his connection to the Pope and his standing of the church. It is based on his Christian character and his connection with Christ, and that you can't be devoid of morals and expect to have any spiritual authority over other people. And so that the course of Huss's thinking. Contrary to Wycliffe, Huss actually believed in transubstantiation. Wycliffe, of course, said, no, that's a novel doctrine. The church didn't always believe that. And Huss did believe in transubstantiation. This is the idea that upon the priest's consecration of the communion elements, that there's actually a spiritual transformation of those things from being bread and wine into the actual body and blood of Christ, even though it does not change in its appearance. Spiritually, it's transformed. Huss actually did believe that. And one of the outgrowths of that whole idea, the notion of transubstantiation, was the fact that people were not allowed to have the communion cup. They could have the bread, but they couldn't have the communion cup. And the reason was, is they were worried that the rowdy peasants might slop the cup, spill some of the blood of Christ on the floor of the church, and desecrate the body and blood of the Lord. And so they said, no, the cup doesn't get passed around. Well, Huss believed, no. You know, the Lord, when he gave us the Lord's Supper, he said, you drink and you eat. And this became incredibly popular in Czechoslovakia, or Bohemia at the time. Very big thing, where Huss introduced and said, no, we're going to have the cup and the bread. Revolutionary at the time. you know, today we look at that and we go, oh, well, you know, everybody has the cup and has the bread. But at the time, that was extremely revolutionary. Another thing that was one an example of Huss's change of thought was that the teaching of the church at the time was that the priest had the power to forgive sins and the power, basically, to determine whether you're going to heaven or hell.
Mercy.
Yeah, they exercised quite a bit of power. And Huss disavowed all such power. He said, this cannot be true. Only Christ can forgive sins. Only God has the power to forgive sins. A priest may pronounce forgiveness, remind people of God's forgiveness, and announce that forgiveness, but they may not forgive a person's sin. That is something that only Jesus Christ can do. So Huss is not exactly a big doctrinal reformer, but you can see that some of his thinking was definitely in a contradistinction to the Roman Catholic Church at the time. And as a preacher of reforms like this, you can only imagine the kind of trouble that Jan Hus would get into. You know, you don't come against the status quo with hitting them right at the points of their power, the Catholic Church, without expecting to get in trouble. And this guy was merciless in his preaching. He'd probably, if he were a preacher in America today, he'd be sued. There'd be class action lawsuits against him because he would, from Bethlehem Chapel, if he knew a priest that was living an immoral lifestyle, I mean, he would name the sins they're doing, give
where
their name,
did it,
where they did it. That, I mean, we're talking, this guy was merciless. You know, he would preach and expose sexual sin, drunkenness, debauchery. Another thing was popular, I'm sure you've heard of this, the practice of simony, the idea of buying and selling. Okay. You know, somebody gets an office in the church that goes to the highest bidder. That was being practiced. And Huss was just, you know, like that. And he would be sued if it were today, but he named names and gave dates. I mean, the guy was a pretty radical preacher. The other thing he had was murals painted on the wall of Bethlehem Chapel that depicted the life of Christ and depicted the life of the Pope. You know, and it would show pictures of like Christ walking barefooted in shabby clothing, and then it would have the Pope, you know, in the finery riding on a horse with a beautiful saddle, and so there was nothing he was doing that would in any way ever ingratiate himself to anybody that you know kept him in power.
And so, was the local Catholic Church? Well, I mean, this was a Catholic church, right? Supposedly Bethlehem Chapel.
Everybody was Catholic back in those days.
Everybody was Catholic, right? So, where did the trouble come from then? If it wasn't coming from Bethlehem Chapel, right there, just kind of surrounding areas,
well,
it come from Germany.
There were other churches. See, there were other churches, and he had an archbishop over him, and there were other priests in town, and he was quite singular in his view, and so pretty soon people are sending spies in to listen to what he's saying about the Pope, what he's saying about other priests in town. The word goes to the king. The king doesn't do anything because he likes Huss and likes what's going on. But the word goes to the Pope, and the Pope starts putting pressure on things. And anyway, there's communication going around, and Huss is starting to fall into some real trouble. But I'm making a story that's very complex. I'm going to try to really simplify it here. But suffice it to say that eventually these reports to the Pope and everything begin to escalate to the point where from Rome, the king of Bohemia is basically ordered to silence Huss and to basically tear down Bethlehem Chapel. They don't even want the building to exist anymore. They want the building physically torn
Raised.
Down.
Mm-hmm.
And Huss had the support of the people, and so the king avoided following any of these orders, and eventually the Pope put Bohemia under what's known as the interdict. And the interdict is the idea that basically no communion is served, no priestly services of confession or last rites are offered, nothing. The whole country is basically, it's like a federal government shutdown, only instead it's all the services that the people depended on from the church, that is completely shut down until the problem is corrected. Well, Huss is a good godly man, and he basically said, look, I don't want this to happen to everybody in Bohemia. And so he voluntarily resigned out of the chapel and left. and left the city of Prague and actually began just teaching in the countryside, out under trees and in the woods and in caves and in little wayside chapels. And he was so popular that basically people just left Prague and went out into the country and listened to him and took communion and still followed him because of the fact that he was their preacher. And he was a great teacher of the Word of God. Well, eventually, in 1415, the situation in the church had gotten so bad with those three popes that a council was called, the Council of Constance, Germany, was called, in which all the leaders around the world from the Christian church, in the Western world, I should say, gathered together, and they had a big agenda. And on that agenda, there were three items. Number one was to determine what to do about these three popes. We've got to come up with somebody that we can all agree on. Interestingly, that church council was attended by more leaders of the church than any church council in the history of the Christian church, even more than the Council of Nicaea in 325. There were over 18,000 leaders that attended. There's written records of the Council of Constance, and I'm a little befuddled because they talk about all the people that came and to supply this. And for this church council, they had 18,000 church leaders, but also 1,500 prostitutes were brought in, and something like 700 or 800 jugglers were brought in. And why church leaders needed to have prostitutes and jugglers, I don't really understand. But be that as it may, this is in the written documentation okay. Of the Council of Constance. But one of the other things that they came to do besides, you know, fix the popes, that you need to reform the church. There needs to be some of these practices that Huss was talking about definitely need to be dealt with. And thirdly, we need to talk about Huss and what to do about him. And Huss is invited to this church council, and they bring him in, and he's guaranteed safe passage. They say, no matter what happens, we're not going to convict you on any heresy. We're going to give you safe passage. What we want you to do is come and explain to us these ideas that are rolling around in your head. And we won't do anything to you about it. We just need to have these ideas clarified. And the king promised safe passage of Huss to and from this council. And of course, when you have to and from, the implication is that you're going to live through it, and yeah, he'll make sure yeah. you get home okay after yeah. it's all over. And Huss thinks, wow, this is my golden opportunity. Surely these godly men at this church council will hear these views that I'm having, and they'll agree, and we'll see these reforms that need to happen in the church, and everybody will be better for it. Well, instead what happens is Huss shows up, and they charge him with 30 charges of heresy. And they don't even talk to him. They don't allow him to talk. They don't. All they say is, we're charging you with 30 counts of heresy, and they extracted all these from different books and things that Huss wrote. Never talked to him about it. They just came up with their charges, and they said, we want you, you're under arrest, and you have a choice. You need to either recant these views or you die. And they take Huss, and they lock him up in a dungeon underneath a monastery, which is another question I have is, why a monastery needs a dungeon? I still wonder about that. And this cell was so small that Huss couldn't even stand up in it. He had to stand crouched all day. They had his feet anchored to the ground, but he had to stay hunched over all day. And then at night, he had to sleep with his arms chained up on the wall. And, I mean, they're treating him like this major criminal. And the conditions were so bad that he almost actually died of illness while he was there. And they kept him, during the Council of Constance, they kept him locked away for 3 months.
Oh, no.
And he nearly dies just from that. And then finally, after 3 months, they bring him in, and they set him down, and they say, well, here's the deal. Either recant or die. And Huss tries to bring it up, and they're like, no. You're not talking. You either recant or die. And Huss is like, I am not going to do this. I am not going to back down and all this with no explanation, because if I do that, then I'm going to misrepresent the gospel of Christ. And he felt like to compromise that was to actually compromise the gospel. And so the church gathers together, and they bring him, and they preach this lengthy sermon Okay, they have Huss standing before them. They preach this lengthy sermon about delivering the unbeliever to Satan for the destruction of his flesh. And then they dress him up in these priestly garments. And then one by one, they rip them from his body. And they pronounce curses on him. And then they bring him out and they say, you know, will you recant? And he's like, you know, I'm not going to do that. And they put this paper crown on that basically it says in Latin, it says King of Heretics. And then they bring him out and they chain him up to this stake and they put firewood all the way up to his neck. And this big crowd gathers around and they burn him alive. And he dies singing hymns. He's actually singing a hymn. He sung a hymn until he suffocated from the lack of oxygen because of the fire. But they just, wow. I know, it's just this bizarre thing. They never even gave him a chance
forum,
to do this.
A chance to talk. It's kind of like another midnight trial that we've heard about in the Gospels, doesn't it?
So this happens. The elaborate ceremony happens. They burn him alive. Interestingly, the Council of Constance does end up solving their problem with the three popes. They fire all of them, and they agree on one, Pope Martin V. But Martin V knows he's hanging on to his power by a thread, and so he basically puts all his efforts on consolidating his power, which means he's going to ingratiate himself to people, which means basically all the reform issues that they had on the table were completely swept aside and had to be brought up 100 years later with Martin Luther. But Huss himself was a national hero, and he was a hero anyway. But the martyrdom only sealed this even in a greater way. And basically the fruit of that was is the people said, okay, you've burned Huss, but that doesn't matter. We're still going to be taking communion. We're still going to be doing the things that he taught us to do. And they basically started vacating the churches and going off into the mountainsides and having their own church services. And there actually became really kind of two churches, the Catholic Church and the Church of Bohemia. And anyway, what ends up happening is 20 years of unresolved civil war over this, where the Pope would send troops into Bohemia to try to, you know, by force bring the churches together. Mm. And it never happened. He couldn't control it, nothing control. They ended up going two different ways. And there was out of that group was formed a group known as the Unitas Fratrum, which later became known as the Moravians. And the Moravians, of course, later influenced John Wesley. And, of course, had indirectly influenced us in America today. So wow. On July 6th, every year, the people of the Czech Republic today celebrate a national holiday called Jan Hus Day. And they honor him, really not so much because of the religious form, but because of his integrity, because he was willing to sacrifice his life for the sake of conscience. And 1929, this is a really interesting thing, Pat, or it's not that interesting, but it's interesting enough to mention it, is the fact that of all people, Benito Mussolini, the dictator of Italia, uh-huh. He actually writes a biography on the life of Jan Hus.
Oh, my gosh.
And he wrote it because he wanted to show that Hus had the courage to stand up to the tyranny of the powers that be. Which I think is quite funny when you think about the fact Mussolini himself was a fascist and all that, but he held out Hus as an example to everybody. And then at Christmas time in 1999, this is right in our recent times, of course, 1999, Pope John Paul made an official announcement from the Vatican that he apologized for the execution of Jan Hus. So, you know, I know it's been a few hundred years since that happened, but the Pope did get around to apologizing for having killed this innocent man. But anyway,
all right. Well, that's I'm glad he did. What the heck, you know? I mean, he was a godly man, stood by his principles. There've been a lot of famous people that have stood by. You know, it's Jesus, no matter what. Or God.
Absolutely.
So anyway, Jan Hus, and was that about it for Jan today?
That's about it. You know, the only thing I can think of, you know, if we want to put a place in our minds as to why we ought to, you know, appreciate him today, I would say just the fact that he was willing to sacrifice his life for the truth, and that he was not going to deny the Lord. And also, I just think of the one of the things that, you know, he's not like